In his 4 years at the University of Virginia, Barry Parkhill helped raise basketball to a national prominence. Now he's helping to raise money for UVA sports. He's considered one of the all-time greats to lace them up in Charlottesville. Barry now joins us to talk about his current job, his UVA experience, the ABA, and perhaps the piece he currently loves most as a UVA administrator, his relationship with former and current student athletes. Along with T-Dubs in California and Doug Fresh-Smith in Jersey City, I'm Mark Jerome with Locker Room Access. And please don't forget to subscribe to us on YouTube and hit the bell to like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. T-Dubs, how many young players do you think know about Barry Parkhill? And what I mean by young players, I mean UVA student athletes entering their first or second year.
I would say none of them. I really know, right? I mean, like, I'm, you know, the age I'm at, I don't know much. Like, I had to research it and look it up, and there isn't a whole lot. Like, there's like one YouTube video that's super grainy of him, you know, winning the ACC, but he also, when people don't remember, I look it up, he scored 50, he still has the record. He scored 51 in a game, and he was the first UVA player ever to be named ACC Player of the Year. He was also ACC Athlete of the Year that year. So, like, talking about putting us on the map, he was also, like, ACC 50 greatest players on the 50th anniversary. There was, like, three UVA guys on that list. He was one of them, right? Brian Stith wasn't, which really pissed me off. But that's another story. But, like, you know, he really represent. He carried the torch for, like, great players coming to UVA. Like, he was the first one. So, a lot, you know, we hear his name a lot in terms of, like, on the Mount Rushmore. But like, this was cool. This was really exciting for me to just hear it straight from him. Like, I think of him as a VAF guy now, which is kind of weird, but also know his name is in the rafters, right? So, I mean, Doug, what did you know about him when you came to UVA?
Yeah, Doug, he played nearly 20 years after he did.
Yeah, it was 20 years after, but I mean, those guys' names were always around. You always heard their names. They weren't around all the time. He was coaching back then, so. But you always heard the name, Tom Sheehy, Jeff Lamp, and whether you ever met him or saw him or not, it didn't matter. So his name was, you know, one of those guys that was always mentioned, and he would come back a little bit and always so positive. Like, he told the story, not on this podcast, but when he came into the locker room and he said, Doug, you're going to have a huge game tonight. And, you know, he said, I made some shots, big shots or whatever. But I, you know, I just always knew the name, man. And it's really impressive. A guy that never planned on going to UVA, came to Virginia by chance, went away, came back, and has been there for 30 years since.
Yeah.
And that's his whole, you know, purpose, which is he's just such a humble, respectful guy, man.
Yeah.
If I scored 50 points in a game at Virginia, everyone in the world would know it.
Yeah. I'd have a tattoo about it. And exactly. So, the other thing is, like, yeah, he seemed really – like the humility piece, like he didn't even want to talk about himself. I mean, he came on here because we asked him to, and I got the feeling like I don't want to sound like I'm bragging about myself, but you know, what did you think, Mark? Is that
the no, vibe? It's yeah. True. And again, like, I know we say this about everybody, almost everybody on the podcast, they're the nicest guy. They're the best person. He right. Really, really is such a nice guy. Like, he didn't know me ever. And I guess we were down there visiting, and he came up to me and said, hey, I have friends in New York and they know you guys. And he was just so nice and unassuming. And again, so humble.
Humble is looking definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he's respectful.
His ABA stuff. Like I really wanted to go in on all his ABA stuff. But I know, like, short on time, but the Dr. J stuff was so cool. Like hearing about that in his pro career and just how basketball was back in that era.
Yeah, we'll have to get him on again to talk about the ABA stuff, because those are some great stories with that team that he played for and how that team was actually run and who the owners of that team were. Yeah.
They went on to become.
Yeah.
For all the kids out there, Google it, St. Louis Spirits, like the craziest story and the amount of money they made off of not owning an NBA team, but on the acquisition, the merger, I should say. Pretty cool. What did you think, Dougie, overall?
Overall, the podcast?
Yeah.
I think it's great. Like, it makes me, you know, as Mark makes the point, it's like the best, the most humble guy we've had yet, et cetera. You think about the pillars, right?
Yeah.
And it's just cool to see the guy serving Virginia in his capacity. It's his job. But he takes it seriously, man. He talks so glowingly of Tony Bennett.
Yeah.
You know, every player he thinks is family to him. He looks at them as like their kids, his kids, I should say. I don't know. I mean, find me a better human being, and we'll all be better off for it, you know?
I mean, there's the thing that I find interesting is the parallels. Like, we're all talking about these pillars and stuff, but he's been around way before Tony Bennett, right? So, like, it's amazing. I don't know what, the style and culture of Tony Bennett fitting into UVA. That's just, like, crazy to think about, right? The guy, I mean, he was here for Gillen, Lado, everyone, and basically as a similar to Tony Bennett in his style, which is kind of cool.
My favorite thing is when he referred to Dr. J having a dunk and he flushed it. That's such a lost word. Yeah. Art flush. He said flushed he'd go it. Around the back and flush it. I haven't heard that in forever. Totally made my day and made him more hip.
Flushing. That's right. I mean, right. Dr. J, man, kid. Yeah. It's a shame we can't find. I mean, all the footage. There's no Barry Parkhill footage out there. It really is disappointing. Is that one video? We'll link it in the description. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. I think another thing, Marky. I don't know if you want to hit on it, but him talking about coming to the ACC before there was real, true integration in sports, and he told us something which was more interesting. There were no women at the University of Virginia his first year, yeah. or it was his first. So yeah. The guy saw everything.
It's crazy. That's great. Like my dad, first Asian professor at UVA in 69, he also talks about that. There were no women. So when he got here, it was like true, you know, just white dudes. Like it's just the way it was, right? It's just things change over time.
Mr. Barry Parkhill now joins us. Thanks so much for coming on. Such a pleasure to have you.
It's my pleasure, and I'm honored, Mark. Good to be with you guys.
So 2018, Bahamas, or was it 2017, at the Bahamas tournament when we played against Dayton, and then we beat Wisconsin in the championship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We saw each other outside the gym. And by the way, you're in great shape. And we were talking just about your job, and I still recollect you saying it's the greatest job ever. And I guess for a former athlete, it has to be one of the best jobs.
I honestly do have the best job that anyone could have. That's me, Mark. Number one, I love the university. I love athletics. I believe in our mission. The best part of my job is the relationship that I've developed coast to coast over the last 25 to 30 years. By far and away, that's the best part of my job.
But it's never easy asking for money.
I would agree with that. I think that my responsibility in raising money for Virginia Athletics might be a little bit less challenging than some other development jobs. I've got, in a way, a built-in constituency. I've said this to you before, and we've been through, you know, challenging seasons and great seasons in all our sports, but how hard is it talking about Virginia Athletics all day, every day? It's not like pulling teeth, but I do have a responsibility, and at times you do have to present a proposal and ask somebody to consider a gift, and my role is major gifts.
So it seems like there's been two major issues in recent history, and I mean recent, something going on currently and something recent that happened that could have affected your job positively and negatively. How has winning the national championship helped?
The winning the national championship in men's basketball, you can't put a price tag on it. We did win a national championship in men's lacrosse, and that's a very popular sport here at the university.
Yes, sir.
We had a very good year. Football goes to the Orange Bowl. We're competitive again in football. But I think you could look at last year after we won the championship, and our numbers in terms of members of the Virginia Athletics Foundation skyrocketed. We raised more money on an annual basis last year than we ever have in any year previous. I think a lot of that has to do with winning the national championship in men's basketball, and you've got to throw in men's lacrosse as well. we're pretty doggone competitive across the board, and football is the biggest revenue generator. But winning the national championship in men's basketball, I can only speak for myself and my wife, but that was one of the coolest experiences I've ever gone through and probably ever will.
And now that we're in this crazy pandemic, how challenging is it to raise money?
Right now, in a sense, we're not on hold. I mean, it changes every day in terms of what it's going to look like down the road for college athletics, for University of Virginia athletics. Right now, the big question mark is, are we going to have a football season? And it's still up in the air. I don't think we'll have a football season unless school's back in session here at the university. And I think we're all very, very hopeful that that will happen, but things change every day. There will be a major hit on every athletic program across the board. You see it already, but it's a little bit too early to tell just how big a hit it's going to be. And moving forward, there's going to have to be a lot of resets, and there's going to be a lot of people scrambling to, you know, meet their bottom line.
Yeah, I have a question on the reopening of athletics specifically. I totally agree. Students have to be back, athletics, et cetera. What have you guys assessed the risk of more injuries with guys coming back and like, let's just go? Because as you know, it doesn't work like that, right?
Yeah, everything's on the table, Doug. Every possible scenario, and ones that I read about every day that you don't think about, you know, they're talking about with football coming back, how much time do kids need to get in game shape? You know, it's right. The number is usually 4 to 6 weeks.
Yep.
Here's one thing. It's really important. And again, I'm going to be optimistic. We will get back to playing sports. It's all the kids now are back home. And how dedicated and disciplined are you as a student athlete to do your best job to stay in shape?
Right.
And I think
as you know, some guys better than others, right? There's always
Well, in today's world, and it's probably a lot different for me, certainly, maybe for all you guys, but today these kids are trained, nutrition, weight training, strength. There's somebody there telling them what to do every day. Well, now they're back home. And are these kids doing the best job they can to stay in shape? And those kids that do may have a bit of an edge when things open up and teams start competing again. A lot of kids, they need somebody on them to really do the right things. That's going to be very interesting. But injuries, it's all on the table. And we're very concerned more than anything else about our student athletes and the people around them and the students and the faculty and the staff. Everybody, their health is really, really important.
That's interesting to me. Can I ask one more question about, as a former basketball player like yourself, you said winning the national championship. You know, for all of us, like, I felt like I won, you won, TW won, Mark's son won. It's so hard to do, first of all. But as I'm going to put you not on the spot, but in your role now, was there any time that it entered into your mind, if Kyle makes these 3 free throws, my job gets easier? If we put down Texas Tech, was that any of that, or were you just being a fan? And
no, I would say people might disagree. I'm more than a fan. I work at the university. I work in athletics. I know our coaches. I know most of the players. Some I get to know better than others. When I watch a basketball game, any kind of game at the University of Virginia, I feel like I'm rooting for my family. Sometimes I don't like the way I am, but it's like I'm living and dying with these guys. And I'll tell you what, Mark smiling, I really do feel like I'm rooting for my kids. And I could say that about the coaches. I'm old enough to be all their grandfather. But I never thought of it that way. But, you know, when that championship game was over, I cried. I mean, we played. I work here. It's hard to describe. It's the most incredible feeling.
Yep. Same way.
Sure. And you've been in development now at UVA for close to 30 years. How did that happen? Was that an easier part of a transition from professional sports?
Well, no, and most of my working career before I came back to Virginia, I coached collegiately. I coached at William & Mary's, assistant and head coach. I was out of coaching for 2 years. I coached up at St. Michael's College, Division II school up in Burlington, Vermont. And then I coached the Naval Academy for 2 years. And I got wind that there was a capital campaign in the works at the University of Virginia. I threw my name in the ring. I got the job. I did not come back in athletic development. I came back at the university in central development. And when Terry Holland was hired as athletic director, I'd been offered a job at the Alumni Association. Well, I ended up working two jobs because Terry asked if I was interested in raising money for athletics. I said, I'd love to, but I've got this other job that's not going away. So I worked that for a couple of years and then I went athletics full time, you know, 20 some years ago, Mark.
Yeah. So before we go on your time as a UVA player, what's a week like for you as a person in development?
Right now, today I'm on the phone all day, every day with the people I work with. And just, I don't talk shop when I talk to my friends. I mean, I've got relationships with people coast to coast. I'm not talking shop unless somebody wants to talk shop, then I can. I'm just checking in and see how they're doing.
Yeah.
If it's back to the old normal or when the new normal hits, I'm basically on the road every other week to certain areas of the country. And in between, I can spend time in Richmond or Northern Virginia, D.C. I work a lot here in Charlottesville, but I spend time in front of people, which means I spend my life on the road, travel.
How do you handle having conversations about UVA basketball, UVA football, things that maybe have to stay within the family when donors are asking you, yeah, I'm going to give you money. Come on, give me the inside scoop. So I spoke to one of our buddies, one of our mutual buddies, who says he calls you Sergeant Schultz. Our buddy Greg Ledford.
Oh, my goodness.
Because he says you're so tight-lipped and you won't share any information with him when he has discussions.
I learned a long time ago when I first started working to walk on the fence. And athletic development is quite a bit different than university development. People are passionate. And there's a lot that goes into it. There are times, and this is not a knock on anybody, I'm not an expert, but I hear stuff that I'm going, where did this come from? And sometimes you have to educate people. But if it's something I feel like is inside information, I'll either say, I don't know, or I just can't go there. Very rarely does that happen, though. But I don't want somebody knocking on my door here at the university saying, why did you have this conversation? Why did you say this or that? I just don't go there.
Right. Sure. Your time at UVA as a student athlete, right? You helped put Virginia on the map as a player. What was your first year like as a UVA student athlete? And how did you get, let me back up a second. How did you get to UVA?
Well, very quickly, I grew up in State College, Pennsylvania, Central PA, where football and wrestling was pretty big. I'm not knocking anybody I played against in high school, but I played in probably one of the weaker leagues in the country. I was not really recruited at all. The former coach at Penn State, a guy named John Egley, called my coach, Bill Gibson, and said, there's a kid here you should take a look at. So Coach Gibson invited me to a camp in Gettysburg that he helped run before my senior year in high school. So I went down there as a counselor, not a camper. Coach Gibson was not there. He was overseas, but one of the assistant coaches, Chip Connor, was helping run the camp. And I realized at the time they wanted me there to evaluate me, not as a camper, but as a counselor. So counselor games every night. The last night, I lit it up. I couldn't do anything wrong. Just, I didn't think much about it, but the next day my dad comes and picks me up and Coach Connor comes over and says, hey, we'd like you to visit the University of Virginia. I had no idea what he was talking about. So he explained, I said, well, yeah, that sounds great. Wake Forest came in later on that summer. They came to see me work out in State College. They postponed a visit that I was supposed to take to Wake. I'm figuring they just didn't like me. I visited Charlottesville in the fall. You guys appreciate this. It was a Chamber of Commerce weekend, football game. My host ended up being two of my best friends, Frank DeWitt and Scott McCandlish. Had a great weekend. I go to leave on Sunday, go to Coach Gibson's office for kind of the last rites, and he offered me a scholarship. I said, I'm coming. That's great. That was it. Didn't visit anywhere else. And, you know, Wake Forest came in late, but I'd already committed. And that was it.
So what was your thought before that visit? What were your thoughts on UVA as a possible destination? Was it?
Had no clue other than I knew it was a pretty good academic institution and Virginia was in the ACC. And back then, TW, all you really heard about was Duke and North Carolina.
Right.
You really didn't hear about any other school. Right. The basketball part was important. And I was really concerned more than anything about the academics when I first came to Virginia.
Do you ever have conversations with current players and do they say, oh, Mr. Parkhill, I know you are a great player here, or do they have any, they just have no idea who you are?
Well, they see his name all over the place when they're
you don't know me that well. I get to know our players pretty well. As I mentioned, some better than others. I'm not one to really talk about when I played. It's just not a big deal. I'm more interested in these kids and the experience they're having. I will say this, and I've said this before, the one thing that I can take away along with my teammates is we proved that you could win in the ACC where Virginia had never really won before. That's something that's extremely meaningful to all of us.
At what point in college when you arrived on grounds, started playing with these guys, did you know that either you needed to work more or did you know you belonged immediately?
That's such a great question.
That you were able to stay under the radar with the internet and Instagram and everything back in the day.
I do remember, and Doug, you guys had it so much better, but when I first started my first year, I made All-State in Pennsylvania, but what the heck. I came here, I wanted to play, and you couldn't get into U-Haul, you couldn't get in Memorial Gym. So I was grabbing guys in my class, let's go play. Nobody wanted to play. We finally played 3-on-3 at the Dell with three upper-class kids and the two guys that I came in with were scholarship players. Played for about an hour, 3-on-3. I walked off that court saying, I can play here. That was pretty much it.
Ready to go.
I was ready to go.
Yep, that's great.
And in terms of playing time your first year, how'd that work out?
First year back then, Mark, you could not play varsity. We had a first-year team. I don't think we had a dozen games or so. And then, you know, varsity was second year. In a way, I wish it was that way today. I think it would really help everybody, players, coaches, but I don't think they'll ever come back to first year ineligibility because of the cost. That's interesting.
Well, in which way do you think it would help students and players and I'm sorry, student athletes and coaches?
Number one, kids would get their feet on the ground academically and not have to worry about playing. Number two, a lot of kids would have their egos checked at the door. They think coming in, they're the greatest thing in the world. They're going to play right away. And they realize that there are kids that are better than they are. So it would give kids a year to adjust, work on their game, get better, but also academically get their feet on the ground. But again, that won't happen.
No, because it's actually going the complete opposite direction where every kid, like you said, every kid wants to play, but also first year for guys or first freshmen are there a lot of one and dones?
Yep, exactly. Right?
They're either looking to go straight to the G League or possibly some players are looking to go straight to the G League or some, and some are looking to be one and dones, right? So you have a great, great second and third year, right? I mean, what did the coaches say? Did they know your first year that you were going to be a star? And did they know your second year? Your second year in school, I think you averaged 15 and a half points or almost 16 points.
I don't, those things I don't pay any attention to. I was pretty certain I was going to start when I became eligible. And we started off pretty well my second year, which is the first year we were eligible. And fortunately, we played Duke early at home. And we had a great crowd and we won the game. And I think people started coming back. And, we had our ups and downs, but we won. And my third year was probably the best year we had. We ended up going to the NIT, which back then was, I'm not knocking it today, but back then was so much different and quite a bit bigger. My fourth year was not nearly as successful as we all wanted it to be, but it was a brand new team. You know, we graduated four kids from my third year team that were just really solid people, really solid players. The next year we probably had more talent, but we didn't play together that long. It wasn't the same kind of year that we all had hoped for.
I was going to say, you mentioned UNC and Duke being the ones everyone heard of. What was it like going into those campuses to play?
Very different than today. Duke was, they had a great crowd. They were good, but they weren't what they are today.
Right.
UNC was really good. And if I had to pick a second favorite place to play, University Hall is my favorite. My second favorite place was Carmichael, where UNC played. Mm-hmm. They were good. Places packed. They had, their fans were really good. They were loud, but they were respectful. I just loved playing there. And then Maryland, when Lefty got there, Maryland got really good. South Carolina was in the league through my second year, and then they went independent. They were really good. We had some good games with South Carolina. Wake Forest, you know, all the teams, NC State had good players, but Carolina was probably then the sort of the team to beat.
And for the kids that are listening, the game you scored 51. What? That record, I mean, is probably going to stay there for who knows how long. But what was it like after that, walking around campus? Was it a huge deal then? Is it, when people still talk about it today? Was it?
You know, I'm not a good one to answer that question. Was it a big deal? No, I tell people today that was UCLA, but it was just one of those games. You guys have had them, you know, everything that went up went in. The coach I played for in the second half, I do remember, as a timeout, he said, "Hey, you're close to the record. I'm going to let you stay in." I think if he hadn't told me that and I stayed in, I might have had 70 points. I started missing, but, you know, it was a win. It was a win. Oh, boy.
Overall, how do you see basketball now? And then how do you see basketball when you played?
So different. You have to throw in nutrition, strength training. We never lifted weights, Mark, growing up. It was supposedly bad for you. The three-point line has really changed the game. Kids get coaching year-round. We got coaching from October 15th till the end of the season. That's a big deal. Kids are together all summer. The coaches are allowed certain hours per week. They're getting coached and taught. They compete against each other. The nutrition, these kids are really disciplined with their diet as well. But you know what the biggest difference is? The shorts.
Yes, sir.
We have a picture for you.
The photos don't lie, right? You can make
it's the shorts. That's want. The biggest difference. You know, you go here to here.
They're coming back, though. The short ones are coming back.
That's because the companies want to make money. That's why.
Anything to change it up.
Yep. So after you averaged 22 points your junior year, or nearly 22 points your junior year, right? You say after your fourth year, you averaged about 17 points and the team wasn't maybe not as good. What were you thinking during your last year? Were you thinking you're going to the next level? You're going to be a professional basketball player?
Yes, Mark, no question. It's a great question as well, because I think about this all the time with our guys, you know, that are in a position where they'll probably have a chance to play at the next level. I was drafted. The ABA worked in strange ways. I was drafted at the end of my second year. They had a secret draft, and I was drafted. I think the ABA was just testing the waters, but mentally I'm thinking, wow, this is pretty cool. As a second year in college, I had a pretty good idea that I was going to have a chance to play. I could have come out after my third year. I contract everything. I could have jumped into the ABA. And there's a part of me that thinks maybe I should have done it then, because I was playing at sort of the peak of my playing career in college. But I wanted to graduate, and I wanted to play in the Olympics. And I didn't give it much thought, but I, you know, going into my third and fourth year, I knew I was going to have a chance to play.
Right. You know, I was actually talking to Justin Anderson this morning, and he was talking about when is it right to leave and when is it not right to leave, and should you? It's a difficult option to face, right? And difficult decision to make. Do you leave if you're really hot, and does it impact if you stay and you don't have a successful senior season? Does it impact your draft ranking, and maybe you don't get drafted, or maybe you get drafted later? So it's always challenging.
When did you find out from the secret draft that you got drafted? Larry Bird has a famous story where he was picked and he said somebody told him playing basketball in the summer. He had no idea. Was it the same thing?
It came out publicly just after they had this you know, draft that it was through the ABA. I didn't know anything about it other than picking up the paper and reading about it.
Right.
And so when you – no, go ahead.
Your point, Mark, you can't help but think about it, especially my fourth year. I never felt in a way there was any pressure, but you know what? But on the other hand, there was a boatload of pressure. You wanted to succeed. You wanted to win. You wanted your team to win. But you know people are looking, and they're evaluating you. You can't help but think about it. And even more so today with all the social media and all the these kids, unless they don't have a device, they're going to read and hear about it all the time.
Somebody wants to say hi to you.
J.A., looks like he's working out. You give him my best.
Let's go, Justin.
I hear you now, Justin.
Justin, how are you?
Yep.
I got to give him a call. I don't know if I have his right number. I have a couple mobile numbers for him. I'm going to give him a call.
You probably had the burn.
Yeah.
Jay, you don't want the push up contest with me and Mr. Parkhill here.
No, can you hear them or no?
Take it off the screen, Mary.
No worries. He's gonna join here in 2 seconds.
Did you have a sense going into your senior year that your fourth year that you wouldn't be as good of a team, or was that?
No, right? Not at all. You don't think about those things.
Right. No, exactly. I was just curious because
my fourth year, Gus Gerard was a second year, and Gus was a great player. I think one of the more underrated players ever play here. And had a really good career in the ABA and the NBA. Wally Walker was in the first class of kids where you could play right away as a first year of freshman. And Wally was a great player, recruited by just about everybody. So we had, Jim Hobgood was back, who's my class. So we had, some talent, but it just, the two previous years, we played together for a couple of years and really knew each other. So we're mixing in some new players, and it took a while to adjust.
I want to go back to deciding to leave after your junior year or staying for your senior year. And when you look at players now, UVA lost three players after their third year. Did you have thoughts about that?
Very little. I just knew it could happen. But honestly, Mark, I didn't give it very much thought at all. I mean, the money has always been pretty significant. Back then, the money was significant. They were saying after I, got drafted and moved on that it would change. Well, it changed. I wish I were 20 years younger. The money was important, but it wasn't a driving factor. But again, I didn't give it much thought, to be honest with you.
Yep. I got you. I also want to take it back to the development, because there were two questions I really wanted to ask that I get a chance to, and now that I'm remembering, when you're asking people for money, is there a specific group is there like a sweet spot, a range of ages or people who've left the university where you try to hit more than others?
It's most of the people that support Virginia Athletics have a degree from the university or two or three. In athletics, we do get a lot of support from people who did not go to Virginia, but it might be parents of a current player, current student athlete. A lot of times it's people who move into the Charlottesville area who are fans of athletics and they like big time athletics. So they inquire about season tickets, and all of a sudden we've got ourselves a potential prospect. Age means nothing, Mark. I mean, I'm working with, of course, everybody's younger than I am, but I'm working with people anywhere from 30 years old to 90 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Again, when you have to, I mentioned earlier, my primary role is a major gift officer. I've got to find people who have expendable income. And then it goes from there. And a lot of it's the relationship. Sometimes it doesn't take long. Sometimes it might take a couple years.
Yeah.
And it depends on the passion. Athletic giving is also benefit driven. A lot of people give to get, and the more they give, the better their seats, the better their parking, and that will drive a part of it. When we were working on the John Paul Jones Arena, bottom line is we had courtside seats available for a major gift. And from there, the bigger gifts that were made, those people got to come in and pick their seats earlier. So it is driven by benefits, but you know, when somebody gives us seven figures, that's passion. That's not really driven by benefit.
Right. So what's the range of numbers are you talking about when you seek donations, contributions, and support?
Well, the range of numbers could be anywhere from $1,000 to, you know, $50 million. You know, it depends on the project. We've got more going on now than we ever have before. But it just depends on the individual. And we've got multiple buckets of money we raise for athletics, annual giving for scholarship, endowment for scholarship, capital projects for building projects, support for a given sport through their, you know, their budget. So there's a lot of different ways that people can support, generally speaking, or specifically to a given sport.
I'm sure you've learned over the years about the tricks of the trade, so to speak, lack of a better word. Have you ever been blindsided where somebody contacts you or shows up in your office out of left field, never expected, and they're like, I want to donate something significant, and you're like, why didn't I think about that? Or no?
Well, if you're talking about some, yes, a couple occasions. You know, I had a visit with a guy years ago. I won't bore you with all the details, but it was apparent, and I'm thinking, this guy's, you know, he wanted to talk on the phone. I said, no, I want to come see you.
Yep.
So I had a visit with him in his office, and I'm thinking this could be a six-figure commitment. And he ended up saying, well, I think I want to do, it was a seven-figure commitment. Can I do that over a couple of years? I said, absolutely.
Can
and you? Totally unexpected for that number.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, we got to go out and knock on doors. People don't knock on our doors.
Yep. Well, someone comes knocking on your doors and say, hey, I want really good seats, or I want a suite to a football, to Scott Stadium or the JPJ. You're like, what's that looking like?
Well, the conversation right now for football, we can help you out. For basketball, you got to get on the wait list. And the beauty of basketball is, number one, Tony Bennett. We got a great building, and that building's better when it's full. Everybody now wants in the game, so it's very hard to get basketball season tickets. Not impossible, but it's very challenging. And people have to be willing to, you know, make an annual gift, make an arena gift like everybody else did. But it's, for basketball, it's a lot more challenging getting a good seat. It's a nice problem to have.
I was just going to say that same thing. Yeah, sure.
I was going to ask one more, kind of on that topic. So the, just getting off the phone with, you saw Justin, then he got tied. The guys that leave early, particularly for you, right, these guys are going into multi-million dollar jobs. Right, what is your thought process in terms of guys leaving early to go to the NBA? Because obviously that's a great thing for them personally, and probably maybe for contributions down the line. Versus mm-hmm. being you want wanting them to stay at UVA for selfishly for UVA's, you know, success. Like, where do you draw the, what is your head at when these kids are like announcing and deciding?
You know, it's all about the kids. I would say that the way it is, if if you get some really, really good information, you feel like you're going to be a first round pick, you're pretty much going to get guaranteed money. And the thought of injury has always got to be out there. Beyond that, it's a bit of a crapshoot. I'm just always happy with the kids, and you hope they make the right decision, whether it's to stay or to go. I think that we've got a lot of kids playing in the NBA. We've got a lot of kids playing in the NFL. I think we have to treat those kids just like we treat somebody who didn't play a sport, somebody who's a business person in New York City or Chicago or LA. Sometimes it takes some time. And what people don't realize, they read in the paper these contract numbers, and it's pretty significant. They're not getting all that money. No. A lot of times when these kids, when they sign that next contract in the NBA, that's when things are going to be a lot better for them financially. I tell you what I care about most is the financial security of our kids, of our players. That's what I care about most. If the conversation comes up and we talk about, hey, we'd really like you to support our efforts, yes, we have those conversations. And a lot, I got to tell you, in my business, a lot of times if somebody sees Joe Harris's name out there in our list of people who support us, that's really meaningful. That's meaningful to our supporters that say, hey, Joe Harris, what a great player, what a great kid. He's supporting us. That will motivate people. Maybe it motivates some of our players. But a lot of times we've got to get out in front of those kids and explain to them without being a pain in the rear end that, hey, we could, if they want to, it would be great to have their support.
Yeah, because we talked about this with Roger Mason. He said, and he felt a lot of pressure to stay because he was kind of on the fence, you know, between first and second, but he had that injury. But, you know, we sort of went back and forth. A lot of people chimed in on when people leave, they kind of, you know, there's a sense that they don't care about the university, and people stop being fans in a sense versus cheering for them to do well in that next phase long term is better for the university. Like, is that a real thing for in your mind in terms of like, is it one or the other, or can it be both?
I think every kid is different, TW, in that regard. We know we care about everybody. There's sometimes only a few ways we can show that. As an example, if we're talking basketball, which we are, a basketball alumni weekend where former players can come back and watch a game and interact. Beyond that, it becomes a relationship with somebody like me or anybody else in our office going out on the road and, you know, tracking these kids down and beginning a different kind of a relationship. Gotcha. But every person's very different.
Okay, so then on the flip side of that one, you're in the ABA, you're playing professional. Who from UVA reached out to you at that time? Nobody. Or did anyone? Nobody. Interesting.
The whole operation is so much different. I'll bet you back in those days, a guy named Ted Davenport ran the Virginia Student Aid Foundation. He was pretty much a one-man band. In fact, if you roll the clock up to 1976, 77, 78, I came back to grad school. My wife worked for the Virginia Student Aid Foundation, and she and another gal worked in there along with Ted. That's where I met my wife. It's just so much different now. You know, the dollars that need to be raised are much greater. There were very few sports back then, TW, versus right now. So that's just created a bigger budget, and as we all know, everything is going up in terms of cost.
And to add to that, was the ABA providing salaries where somebody from development may have been looking at you as a potential candidate to giving?
I doubt it. Nobody ever approached me about giving back to Virginia. I think I did. I'd have to look back at my track record. I mean, coming out, I thought I signed a 5-year contract. A no-cut contract, and I got a bonus. It's like, wow, this is unbelievable. But again, you find out pretty quickly that, yes, you know, I was very comfortable, but it's not the kind of money that people think it is.
Right. No. What was the difference between NBA and ABA, the biggest differences between those two leagues at that time?
The biggest difference was the three-point shot in the ABA. Beyond that, I think the ABA as a rule, Mark, maybe a little bit more up and down in terms of the style of play. We had exhibition games with NBA clubs, and when you have those exhibition games, you come out of college and you're reading about Earl Monroe or Julius Erving or, you know, players back then, and you find out that, hey, they're all pretty much in the same boat. They just happen to be two different leagues. The one thing I will say, the ABA played in smaller markets, which was very different. But I will say that after the merger, when you look at the All-NBA team, there's just as many former ABA players on that All-NBA team as NBA players. Just, you know, the TV was not that big. And, you know, we played in San Diego and Memphis, along with Indiana, Denver, San Antonio. And back then it was the New York Nets. Now it's the Brooklyn Nets. But there were teams in Dallas, Miami, North Carolina. They were all over the place.
Yeah. Whenever I've looked at highlights from ABA and NBA and I saw the different color ball, I was always wondering, was it a different material? But I got to imagine.
No.
It was the same. I mean, as an older person, understand.
I'm glad you brought that up. And that was, to me, not a big difference. But the first time you see it, it's a regular leather ball. I've got one that's a regulation ABA ball in my basement. It's a great ball to shoot with because you can see the rotation. Yeah. Beyond that, you think you're playing with a beach ball. First time you play 30 seconds, it's a basketball. You never thought about the color. But that was pretty cool. And if you remember back in the mid-'80s, the NIT went with the red, white, and blue ball for a year or two. I've got one of those in my basement. When I was an assistant at William Mary, we went to the NIT and had one of those balls. But it was a great ball to play with.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you, while at UVA, what were the other differences? Were there any other differences between now and then in the game?
Well, it really goes back to just the player development, as I talked about before. Yeah. And these kids, I'm so envious of our players today, and I think quite a bit, how much better a player could I have been, if I had access to what these kids have today? They can't think about it because that's what they have. That's what they know. They're here in the summer, and they're going to summer school. They're catching up or getting ahead, which is great. They're playing every day. You know, it's so different in that regard. It's hard to compare. I mean, we didn't have any structured workout regimen in the summertime. You had to scramble to find a pickup game. Yep. I was in here summer school one summer. There weren't any players around. But didn't know any different. These kids today, they put in the time. I think, my opinion, I think sometimes it's too much, but that's the way of the world. And most right. kids can handle it. Some kids, it takes them a year or so to really adjust to all the things that are thrown at them. It's not just basketball. It's you're going to class. You're on your own. Mom and dad's not there to wake you up. You know, you're getting up early in the morning and lifting. Your whole schedule changes. And these kids got a ton of support to get them on that right schedule.
Yeah, there's no secret to the fact that the guys that work harder get better. You know, guys in my era, you just think Bryant Stith was amazing, so he's going to go to the NBA. Bryant worked harder than everybody, anyone on our team. John Crotty, I can go through the list. Those guys, there's no secret to, like, how much work you put in as to what you get out.
Great point.
I was going to say, what about when you got to the ABA ranks? Was the regimen different? Did the guys have a different attitude in terms of basketball, life, balance? Obviously, there's no school, right? So
I think the parties were more important.
The workouts. You know, and pro life then is very different than today. I mean, just for the sake that these kids get on a charter plane after a game and they go to their next city. You know, we spent the night. The league rule was you had to take the earliest flight out to get to your next destination. So you're getting up at, you know, 5:30 in the morning. You're jumping on a plane. And as I mentioned, ABA, smaller markets, you're taking a flight somewhere to get somewhere else instead of a direct flight.
Right.
So you're flying half the day. You check into your hotel. You got a game that night. It was so different. And again, what you do realize pretty quickly, I don't know if you've had this conversation with Ty, Mark, but when you play professionally, it's a job. And you got teammates, and a lot of those teammates, they want your job or you want their job.
Yep.
You hope you have a really good group of guys. I always play with a really good group of guys, but it is a job. And a lot of times when you're done practice, you're going home by yourself, and your teammates are going home to their families, and they have kids. You get closer to some than others, but you've got to adjust to that. And that's one of the big differences of playing professionally versus being in college.
Was there, I'm not sure on the timeline of this, but it's something interesting to me. I know in the South, let's say the racial divide of when, say, the first black guy in the ACC came in, Cam Newton, I think, was the first SEC guy for the Alabama. I think he said, I'm just getting the best players, and they happen to be black. Were you fully integrated when you played, or was it a difference going to the ABA where there was a lot more?
It was not. I played with the first black basketball player here at the University of Virginia. Al Drummond was a year younger than I.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Probably. ABA, just very different. I mean, if you go back, if there was integration, let's say back in the 60s, I think the whole makeup of the ACC would have been very different. Maybe a guy like Earl Monroe plays at NC State versus Winston-Salem. Right. You can go, there's a long list of players that were great, great players. Herm Gilliam, he played at Purdue. I'm sorry, he's from Winston-Salem. But a lot of players that play at NAIA would have played in the ACC. And it just, you know, really changed when there was integration.
That's interesting. Were there any thoughts like around for you guys thinking about that? Or was that you just playing and whoever I play with, that's
zero.
All family, as you said, right?
Zero thoughts.
That's amazing.
But, Doug, what I thought about a lot as I've gotten older is, and I go back to our football program, four great guys that were a year younger than I, Stanley Land, Harrison Davis, Kent Merritt, and John Rainey. They were the first four black football players of Virginia. And you didn't think much about it then, but how tough must that have been for them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even a big difference my first year here, there were no women here.
Yeah.
University didn't go co-ed until 1970. And I've talked to, I know a lot of girls who are in that first year class. And I'll tell you what, they had some challenges.
Sure.
A lot of challenges that people don't realize. So there's that, a lot of things that people had to deal with back then.
Right. And then so staying on that same theme that Doug brought up about African-American players, I think it was 66 when University of Texas El Paso, now which is called now University of Texas El Paso, I think it was Texas Western, started five black players against Kentucky. What kind of impact did that have on the ACC? And when the first African-American players started playing at Virginia and in the ACC in general, was it welcoming? Was it how challenging was it? And what was it
you
like
know
at
what?
UVA?
I can't really answer that. Al Drummond could answer it better. Al Drummond passed away several years ago. I never noticed anything that was challenging. I'm trying to think. University of Maryland, I can't think of the name of the player, was back in the late 60s. Norwood Todman, I believe that name is correct, went to Wake Forest back in the late 60s. I would venture a very educated guess that probably for a lot of guys it was really hard, and I'm sure they had to persevere. Some maybe not as challenging as others.
I know I'm friendly with a guy from New York who played, I think he played in the early 60s, maybe late 50s, and he went to Georgia. And he tells the story, if he was a New York legend, he tells a story when he went they went somewhere to go play, I don't know, somewhere in the South. And the rest of the team, I think he was the only black guy on the team, and everybody went in the front door to eat, and he was told he had to go in the back and get food as get takeout food.
Yeah.
And putting into the restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he shares those stories, which are, you know, very, very depressing to hear, as we can all imagine.
Yeah, no, I've heard, you know, stories like that with football and basketball and other sports.
Yeah. And do you find that because of sports, you and your experiences, and you see them having those experiences, does that put some onus on you to stand up and help in terms of the integration and the education of, you know, the general population? Or is it something you can't at that point? It's just too difficult to manage.
I don't even know it's difficult. It just, it didn't go through one's mind when I was in school. There were some interesting times. And again, you guys are all younger. I mentioned co-education back in it would have been the spring of 1970 when there was Vietnam War and all the student protests. School was canceled early here at the University of Virginia. And there were riots and arrests, and it was a very unique time to be here. That's not talking about the same thing as integration for, you know, Black basketball players, football players, student athletes.
Right, right.
But you think about all the things that happened in the early 70s. You just went through it. You didn't think much about it while it was happening, but you can read a lot about it now. There was a lot of change here at the university then.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure. And Dean Smith, who was a champion of civil rights.
Big time.
Right?
Yep.
He probably had an impact, I would imagine, on the ACC and basketball and sports in general, taking such a great stand.
Charlie Scott, and that's been documented. And again, it just made the ACC better for all the right reasons, and for that matter, everywhere else. I mean, I grew up in Central PA. My hometown surrounds Penn State. Wasn't the same in Pennsylvania as it was. I don't consider Virginia South. Most people do. I think we're Middle Atlantic.
I'm from Tennessee. It's not the South.
But I tell you what, when I was in school, people said, boy, you're going way down south to school.
Right.
But it was
me being from Tennessee, I had people saying, don't get that accent when you go up there to the north. Boy. what was it, looking back, was it boring playing with a bunch of white guys all the time or no?
I to this day, I don't play anymore. I miss playing, but I just love basketball. I feel so bad for the kids today, you know, like Ty and DeAndre and Malcolm and Joe and all the guys. Can you imagine, Mark, Doug, not having a basketball in your hands for a week, let alone a couple weeks?
A couple months.
Like every day. I just can't imagine. I'm sure they're innovative. You know, maybe they're dribbling or working on ball handling drills and getting out and shooting buckets.
Yeah.
These guys today are spoiled. They're not used to shooting outside.
Well, right. you bring up a good point, because now guys are going to go to great lengths to make sure they can play, right? Mm-hmm. So Ty has left Phoenix, DeAndre's left Atlanta, and now they've moved into a house together, and Devin, in Charlottesville, so they could all work out in Charlottesville, right? So
whatever it takes.
Right, right. So they can't imagine being without the basketball for a week or two. They have to get it in. That's how committed, and that's how much love they have for and passion they have for the game.
And back in our time, Mr. Park, if you agree, you talk about the pickup games. You would kill to play 5-on-5 for 3 hours every day, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, and imagine being without that. These guys are so much more structured now. They talk more about working out than they do about, let's say, playing, which I always find interesting. You know, we just talk about playing at Slaughter, the pickup games, just to get away from the structure that was our team.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go do different things, you know, shoot more. Jeff Jones isn't screaming at me, whatever the case may be.
There are certain aspects of college that you could argue these kids miss out on. I don't personally. I don't think any kid would trade their basketball experience. But I think in today's structured world for athletics, kids do miss out on, you know, university clubs, sororities, fraternities, other things that kids might get involved in. But again, I don't think they trade for anything.
Sure. So again, we're gonna take it back to the ABA. What were your thoughts when you got drafted?
You're excited, Mark. I mean, you're getting a chance to get paid for something you love to do. Yeah. I was drafted by Portland in the NBA, and I knew Virginia would be the team because of the way they operated. They had the secret draft and all that. I chose the ABA because it was in Virginia. The Squires were located in Norfolk. Julius Erving was on that team. George Gervin was on that team. Swen Nader and I, if you guys remember Swen Nader, we signed the same day. We were roommates my rookie year till he was sold. It seemed like a good thing to do. I mean, hindsight's 20/20. I maybe have had it do over again out of sign with the NBA, only because of the position I played. I was a point guard, and the point guards in the ABA were small and quick, and I was not small and not quick. The NBA guards are a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. But, you do what you do. It's such an eye-opener, because all of a sudden you're starting all over again, and it's not like going to college. You're starting all over again, and you're going with a bunch of guys that are mostly older. It's a job. The whole training cycle changes, and you have to adjust.
Was your mindset before you got to the league, this is my job? Or you like, I'm going to go have a fraternity again, like I did at Virginia with my teammates. And then you kind of got the slap in the face of, this is a job.
No, I don't think I look at it either way. It's hard to remember back almost 50 years, Doug, but, I knew it was a job. You're excited. And a lot of it, you adjust based on your teammates. I'd play with a bunch of good guys. And there's an adjustment to the game. There's adjustment to the physical part of the game. I don't think I adjusted very well early on back then. And, maybe some coaches were different, but you don't get a lot of individual coaching. It's all team. Right. And you don't get a lot of individual instruction to help you get better, to sort of teach you how you guard your guy, all this stuff, a little bit different. And maybe that's changed today.
I love how you casually throw names out like Julius Erving and Sven Nader and those guys, like no big deal. That's pretty cool for me.
Well, I mean, that's
that's what it was.
You know, Julius Erving, I think Julius Erving, more than anybody, created the merger of the ABA and the NBA. But listen, I played with the St. Louis Spirits for 1 year. That franchise was only in existence for two. And during that year I was there, a lot of names you guys would never heard of. Marvin Barnes, maybe one of the best players I have ever laid eyes on. Moses Malone, Caldwell Jones, Maurice Lucas, Ron Boone. Freddie Lewis, Don Chaney, ML Carr, Gus Gerard, Mike D'Antoni, on and on. You know, there were some pretty doggone players, good players in the ABA.
That's an amazing list. It's,
yeah, fantastic. Amazing. So you did 3 years with in the ABA, correct?
Correct.
Why did you stop playing?
When the merger took place, I was kind of merged out. Didn't have. That was pretty much it. I had obviously not much of a career. I started most of my second year with the Squires, and then I was traded. Just a pretty nondescript career. But an experience it was. I can't say it was fantastic. It wasn't horrible. When you get to that level and you start playing, you think, I'm going to do this for 10 years.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's over, and then you have to move on.
Sure. Well, we definitely want to hear some stories, and we're going to take this now to the impression series that TW runs segment. That's fantastic. It shows you pictures, so we'll hopefully hear some of those stories during that time.
Whoa! And
here's the first one. It says the Cavalier Captains. It's a photo from the program, and it has you and Jim Hobgood. I was going to say I remembered Jim as the radio guy. Maybe you could, I'm sure a lot of fans remember him as well, so many years on the radio. What, can you tell us a time, a story or two of that time?
Sure. Jimmy was from Uniontown, Pennsylvania, where Gus Gerard was also from. And I read about Jim when I was in high school. He was an all-state player. His high school, Laurel Highlands, won a state championship. I watched him on TV. We were co-captains. We roomed together our second year. Jim was an underrated rebounder and a great shooter, left-handed. He would have thrived with three-point shot. I look at that picture, number one, the shorts, and number two, I wish I had some of that hair back in the color of that hair.
What about the sneakers?
Oh, God, the best.
Would you have jumped higher? Would you have jumped higher with the Nike shoes today?
You know what, Mark? With the shoes and the floor these kids play on today, I had some pretty decent hops. I could have jumped better with the technology.
All right, and then
me too.
we haven't talked about this. This is 71 in front of now gone U-Haul. I originally had the U-Haul demolition picture in here, but I thought I'd pick a more positive one. What do you remember about this? Does this ring any?
I'm thinking that would have been looking at the players my third year. Gosh, I'm looking at two of my best friends who have since passed away. That's Coach Gibson holding the trophy. That might have been we played in a tournament down in Charleston, South Carolina, and we won the tournament. That might have been when we came back. You know, that was a really good team. And I can't tell you stories about that Charleston tournament, unfortunately. There's some good ones.
I think some real good ones. I think the caption was for this one was, this is a picture celebrating the first time we were, I think, ranked in 17 years and we have winning that chip. So a picture of kind of this is the first picture of putting Virginia on the map, which I thought was really cool. It's in front of U-Haul.
You know, that would have been my third year. My second year, we went through a stretch where we got ranked for the first time ever for a basketball team. This season, we got up as high as sixth in the country. And we lost some games down the stretch. We got it going pretty good that year.
That's awesome. Next one.
Oh, good Lord.
This is a Topps photo. If you dribbling with that ball.
Is that Pete Maravich or Mr.
What do you remember about this photo shoot and this Topps? Like, what happened with this? Do you remember?
Well, obviously nothing happened with the bubblegum card, but I remember we had just gotten some new uniforms. But other than that, and back then, Converse came out, if you guys remember, with a leather shoe that I wore, I think, my third year. But back then, they still had canvas Converse. Not much to remember, though, about that, other than I still wish I had some of that hair back.
That's good.
And then going on some UVA stuff, I was just curious. Obviously, you were in the ABA during this time. Are you just left? What are your recollections of what was your relationship with Virginia at the time of this? This is the game of the decade, Ralph Ewing.
Vividly remember the game. Honestly, I can't remember the year and as to where I would have been. I was probably at that time coaching at William & Mary. And I don't even know if I watched the game because we probably had a game that night. But I do remember we beat them. It was obviously a huge game. But that's maybe one of the bigger college basketball games ever, if you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's got to be 82 or 83, right? Am I right?
Got to be early 80s, yes.
82, I believe.
Yeah, because I remember. I remember.
And then a similar one. This is a picture of the upset that we think about with Chaminade, guys on the rim. Where were you? What do you remember about this game and this upset?
Again, I'm sure I was still coaching. Remember reading about it. you know, there's a bit of a shock. I've made this comment, and I'll make it here, that when we lost to UMBC, I'll bet you all the players at Virginia who played on this team breathed a little bit of a sigh of relief based on the magnitude of the upset. But you know what? This game is highlighted every year at Thanksgiving,
yep,
when they have those tournaments out in Hawaii.
Yep.
And I'm sure the same thing will happen with the UMBC game. But you know what? Guess what happened a year later?
That's right. That's right.
I think that young man is from Virginia in that picture.
Yeah. He played in Ralph's High School, right?
That's it. Something like that, yes.
And then next, the Pete Gillen era. I know you were at the university at this time. Yes. I just wanted you to comment in terms of what it was like then, asking for donations and all during that sort of like rough patch.
You know, any time that we're doing something in athletics, when things are going well, the conversations are a little bit easier. As you guys all know, Pete got it going here. Mm-hmm. I remember a loss we had. We were ranked in the top 10. We're playing Maryland at home. They were ranked. That's the year they won the national championship. And we were ahead 3 minutes ago. And I remember, I think it was Travis Watson, who, by the way, in my opinion, is one of the very most underrated players that ever played here. I think he missed a foul shot. Maryland ended up winning the game. And teams kind of went in opposite directions. But Pete's a great guy. Pete's won like 300 or 400 Division I college basketball games. Not many guys can put themselves in that class. And again, he really got it going here.
And in terms of like your outreach, because I remember that time there was a lot of complaints about U-Haul and JPJ was coming. Was that a crazy busy like time for you?
Yes. Conversations again, when you don't have it going, there are some people that said, hey, come, I'm asking people, we're all asking people to make big investments. And people are saying, well, come back when we're better. And my comment was, this new arena will help us be better. Sometimes people don't want to hear it. That's fine.
Right.
But we got it done. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history.
Absolutely. And then the next one. This is the guys marching on the lawn. Where were you when you heard this? What was going through your mind? Given
I was at
the
home.
Conversation we
I was,
had.
I was home that weekend. The one thing I take away from that weekend, which I think is really unfair, that impacted so many people. But I think some people realize and some don't that really impacted Coach Bennett and our basketball program. Because a lot of kids, I believe at that point in time, it was August, and they were committed to visiting University of Virginia. They didn't commit to come here, but they were committed to visiting. And when this took place in Charlottesville, a lot of kids decommitted on their visit.
Yeah.
And they probably heard from opposing coaches that were telling them, look what's going on in Charlottesville. Do you want to go to University of Virginia? And
how can you not, though, right? How can you not be concerned?
Yeah, I hear you. The whole thing was just really sad. That could have happened anywhere.
Yeah.
It just happened to happen here in Charlottesville. I think there's still things that have happened since then, but I think hopefully we're past all that. But I think that impacted everybody, but it really impacted I remember the basketball program.
And Mark, you've talked about it a little bit, but like you said, you had a call with Coach Bennett, right?
Yeah, as soon as it happened, I was in Vermont with Ty, with my two sons, and we're watching it on TV, and we're following it and reading about it, and I was immediately concerned, and just thinking about, like, this is where my child – this is really where my child goes to school?
Right.
This is unreal, right?
All right, let's
I think,
say
– Well, I think what Mr. Parkhill's saying without saying it and the way I looked at it, aside from how obvious how bad everything was, that's not Charlottesville. That's not the University of Virginia.
It's not.
Like, we know that, right? That's not what people are really family.
Right. Right. But as a parent, right, your child's got to be around that.
Right.
And then when are they going to come back? Right. And what happens if they do come back? Right. How's it going to be handled? And how was it handled when it was going on?
So obviously this question is for you, Mark. That scenario that we just brought up, let's just say the timing is different. Ty's has scheduled his official visit. This happens to UVA. You come from a family that has stood up for this. Right. Would you?
No, it's a good question. And both of my parents were on the front lines of the civil rights movement, right?
Right.
Marching,
right.
Protesting, you know, and I'm sure like Barry said that there were probably tons of coaches who were trying to dissuade people,
right.
recruits from going to UVA and pointing at this incident. I don't think that, you know, I don't, first of all, we shouldn't run from it. Right. And we should confront it and deal with it. But also I agree that it's not the University of Virginia. How many of these people were actually from Charlottesville versus how many people came in from other states, right. or other places.
Right.
But also I think it's also what some of this is missing and what we're not talking about is why this protest happened. Right. And what's the perception, and also what's the representation of what people believe of the statues on campus or the statues downtown, right? And I think that has something to do with it. And I think it was important to those statues can represent painful memories and painful thoughts for a lot of people,
right?
Right. And I think if there are people who are and UVA Bennett was outstanding when I had the conversation with him. Right. And I think he represents anybody else
so
I've
much.
Talked to.
Right.
Anybody else I've spoken with that represents UVA. Right. He's a reflection, I think, of the university and of how and the administration and anybody else I've spoken to about it. It was actually very comforting.
All right. I'll lighten the mood. We talked about this earlier. Short shorts coming back. What are your thoughts, no. Mr. Park?
Wait a minute. Did you see his reaction? Did you see Barry's reaction?
I mean, they're rolling them up to look like he used to look.
For the audience members, Barry Parkhill's reaction was immediate disbelief. We're looking at a picture of Chris Paul and James Harden, whose shorts are rolled up. All the way up.
Quads up
to their thighs.
Quads out.
Those are a lot longer than ours, too. I don't really have a reaction. I think it's what looks decent and what's comfortable is really important. I'm not seeing this one. I know a lot of kids now, they're not rolling them up from the bottom, they're rolling the waistbands to bring the shorts up. I kind of like the NBA, I believe they used to have a rule where you had to be so many inches above your kneecap.
Right.
You remember years ago, guys were wearing shorts and they were going below their knees. I don't know. I could play in that.
LeBron. Yeah.
It reminded me of pedal jumpers or pedal pushers, whatever we called them back then.
Also, it's crawling, you know, drilling between your legs there. I was always worried the ball would get hung up in the shorts.
Right.
Down there.
Could you do that, Doug?
Did I do what?
Could you dribble between
my
legs?
I was better behind the back. Left to right only.
And then here, this next photo.
Oh, my man.
The ABA All-Star.
Yeah.
And iconic in turn. Like, you know, when I think of dunk contests, this is who I think about. Not Jordan, but that also ages me a little bit. What do you remember about those dunk contests in the ABA? Did you go to them? Did you see them in person? Did you?
No, I never went to the All-Star game, of course. You know, it's interesting. Doc was here a couple of years ago at a football game, and I ran into him at halftime, chatted for a little bit. We had a Virginia Squires reunion many years ago where Doc came, George Gervin came, a lot of the guys came. It was really fun. If you guys, the next time you have a basketball in your hands, Doc, with his hand, his hand was enormous. He could overlap three sections of a basketball. And you check it out the next time you have a basketball in your hands. But I remember one game, and I can't use the language. We were playing. Is it okay to tell these stories?
Oh, yeah, please.
I'll fill in for the language. Don't worry.
We were playing the New York Nets, Mark, out in Long Island at the Nassau County Coliseum.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And I think it was my second year. I was the only point guard then. I mean, I was playing. We were playing four nights in a row and playing 40 minutes. And we're playing the Nets, and they're really good. And I used to have to guard Brian Taylor. And there was a play where the Nets had the ball. I'm guarding Brian, and Julius does some move along the baseline. He goes up and just crushes it. And I turned to look at him. I went, holy mackerel. I didn't exactly say it that way. He said, I see that every day in practice too. He did things that were just – I wish they had highlights of him in the ABA.
Yeah.
He did a lot of those things in the NBA, but he was so electric. And he played on a really good team as well.
I mean, I just as a kid, there wasn't a lot of ABA highlights that you could see, but when they showed it, they did the free throw one, and then they did the one where the Lakers, Michael Cooper, where he went over, and then they did the one in the baseline where he curls almost out of bounds and back around, and like, you know, the NBA is fantastic. You saw that thing 100 times every season. Like, it was amazing.
You guys have seen there's a highlight that they still show every once in a while. It was a Sixer Laker game. Jabbar was playing. Yep. Doc goes up and under and flicks the ball off the board, twists it, and it spins it in. Back in the ABA, he'd come around the other side and dunk it. He'd flush it. He wouldn't just flip it off the board. The guy was just amazing. And a really good guy. Really, really good guy.
And then back – we're going to jump back to – oops. Back to UVA here. And, wow, I can't seem to get out of –
Oh, the doc won't leave us.
There we go.
Oh, man. Purdue.
The Purdue game.
Oh, God.
This is Tony Bennett screaming after cutting down the net, just so for the listeners, not viewers.
We were at that game, obviously. I'll never forget that game and that picture. I think the emotions were pretty incredible from a guy who is pretty good about keeping things – on an even keel. Never forget that picture.
And
have you seen a better college basketball game than that one? And you've spent plenty of years to be an expert on this.
No, especially with what's on the line. We've all seen great, great games, but what was on the line there and how, I mean, everybody talks about the kid from Purdue. We played a doggone good game. Yeah. And just did what we had to do.
And the high level of plays that individual players made both ways to me was rewatching it was incredible.
Absolutely.
And where were you actually standing when he was making the screen? Were you on the court or were you?
No, I tell you what, I had really good seats and a buddy of mine who's a great supporter couldn't come. So I flip flopped my wife and I into his seats. We were probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 rows behind our bench. So I was looking right at it.
That's great.
Good for you. Just amazing.
And then the flip side of that. This is a picture of the UMBC Retrievers making a layup. What was going through your mind at that point? Right, we lose that game. Where were you first off? Were you at the?
I was about a little higher up behind our bench. That was maybe 30 rows behind our bench. And, you know, I do remember the emotions. You know, halftime, it's close. We'll be fine. They started off, I think they scored 8 points in a row.
Right.
Didn't feel that nervous. And then, you know, with about, I don't know, 12, 10 minutes to go, you sort of had that feeling. And you got to the point you could see it on our guys' faces.
Right.
And I don't think what you hear that much is the kind of game that UMBC played. I mean, they played a heck of a game. You got to give them some credit. But it's an amazing story, you know, after the fact, based on what happened, the result of this game, and then what happened a year later.
So after this, obviously this offseason, you're making calls, catching up with donors and the likes. What is the sentiment? What is the mood? Is it embarrassment? Is it, what is it?
Embarrassment, I would say no. Some people might say that. I would say it's just people are disappointed, but you know what? Because of the character that Tony has and his family and his coaches and the players, you know what? I think people felt really bad for them, not embarrassed.
Right.
They feel bad for him. And you just move on. And nobody moved them on better than Tony did and our players, the way they handled it and the way they moved forward from it.
Right. And as a coach, if you went into the season, Coach Parkhill, and somebody said you're going to lose 3 games this year out of 35, you'll probably take that every time, right? I'm not telling you what game it's going to be, but you're going to lose 3.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Comparing that to the mood versus after the Chaminade game, I mean, obviously you were at William & Mary, you're coaching. What was that emotion like for you, comparatively speaking?
Well, no comparison, TW, because I was somewhere else then.
Yeah.
I cared, but I was coaching somewhere else and living a different life.
Right.
Versus this one, I'm working in athletics.
You're in it.
I'm totally tied in every way possible, and just. And I remember after the game, I took a friend and supporter back to his home, and I left Tony a voicemail message. And I said, don't call me back, but I felt for him, and I just conveyed that my message. And I remember back, guys, when we lost in Chicago to go to the Final Four to Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I remember I felt bad for our team, but I felt bad for Coach Bennett. And his post-game remarks, and he did the same thing at this game, pick people up, just the way he handles it. And very few coaches could have done that. And probably a lot of coaches would not have gone on national TV
right
after the MVC game. He did it, and there's nobody that handles it better than Tony.
Yeah, that was both of those incredible. I think we'll move on. The polar opposite of this. This is Minneapolis. Roger Mason, Harold Dean, Josh Hare, Sean Singletary, Malcolm Brogdon, OG Whitebone, whoever that is. where were you? What is your story on? That championship weekend, getting to Minneapolis.
I was there. I took the charter up Friday. There was a pre-game get together of a lot of former players on Saturday afternoon, which I went to for a while. A ton of former players were there, which I thought was really cool. I was so wound up and nervous. I went there for a while. I went to the arena, and I just wanted to take it all in, which I did. And my wife made the call before that she was not going to go. And so I'm there by myself, and I talked to my wife multiple times a day. On Sunday, we're talking, and she says, "Doggone it, I used to work in athletics, and here I am at home, and we're playing a national championship game." I made a couple calls, sent a couple emails out, and got her a flight up on Monday, private flight. I gave her my seat on the flight back to Charlottesville on Tuesday morning, and I got a ride back with a friend. So we were able to take it in together. And what can you say, guys? You could write a book about this. It was just an amazing experience.
So cool just to see that. All right, this next segment, we're going to call this buy, sell, or trade in terms of – you know, these are cards. I pulled up some old cards. Wanted your thoughts on these guys.
Well, now when you say buy, sell, or trade,
buy one, sell one, trade one.
I am going to probably give you an answer you don't want to hear. I'm buying them all. Othell Wilson, incredibly talented player. You know, I think he was NBA caliber. He got a little bit of a smell at the NBA. Rick Carlisle, great player, overachiever, had a hell of a career playing, and he's one of the best NBA coaches ever. I will not tell you that I have a favorite Virginia player. I can't say that because there's too many, but Jeff Lamb's one of them. Unbelievable player. I get a chance to talk to Jeff hopefully once a year, see him every once in a while. He used to come back to work the NBA Players Association camp that was held at the John Paul Jones Arena that's been canceled. Guy was just a stud. And not only a great player, but just one of those guys that he did whatever it took to win games. And his teammate, high school teammate in college, to me, is also one of the most underrated players ever at Virginia. And that is – actually, there are two of them. One is Lee Raker. The yes. other is Jeff Jones. If Jeff Jones plays on a different team, he Jeff Jones could play. Yeah. He just yep. had Ralph Sampson, Jeff Lamb, Lee Raker to throw it to. But he was a great player.
That's awesome. And then we got two more of this style. We got Corey Alexander, rookie card. Roger Mason, John Crotty.
Again, I'm buying them all. Roger Mason, talented. John Crotty, again, you got to say, guys, he had probably one of the best NBA careers of any guy that ever played professional basketball in Virginia. He's also one of the most underrated players.
Yeah, absolutely.
Still in the game. I'm taking them all.
And Roger Mason talked about you helped him get home after Minneapolis.
It's who you know sometimes, DW.
He was like, at first he kind of mentioned I wouldn't say fractured relationship with the university, but he just always felt like because he left early, people didn't really care about him. But then he was like, no, Barry takes care of me, which I think is pretty cool.
I care about them all.
And then last one. You got Don Staley, Brian Stith, and Malcolm Brogdon, because this leads into freshest question. But
I mean, you got to say Don Staley, maybe one of the best women basketball players ever at any level, period.
That's right.
Yep.
And now she's one of the best coaches, but just an unbelievable player. And the credentials aside, which they're great. She was just phenomenal. Brian Stith, total stud. Just, the kind of player you want on any team. Great kid. I don't know that he's underrated, but he's got to go down as one of the couple best players ever to play at this university and had a great pro career, great family. Malcolm, I think Malcolm's going to be president of the United States somewhere down the line. I know Malcolm pretty well, and incredible career, great ambassador. He's just a great human being that happens to be a great basketball player.
All right. That's the end of it. We appreciate that. I'll let Dougie take over in the last question.
Okay, we do my segment every podcast, and it's going to be a tough one for you, but it's your own criteria. Could be the best guy, the best player, the whatever, but you're Mount Rushmore of Virginia basketball, and you get five of them.
I'm going to probably shouldn't say this, but I was sort of prepared for this question, and you're not going to like my answer.
Well, you know way more of them than we all do. So.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to have the kind of answer you want, and I'll say why. It's because it goes back to relationships, and I cherish the relationships I have with everybody. But we're talking about Virginia basketball. I cherish the relationships I have with all the players I've gotten to know, some better than others. I can't give you five. I don't know if I could give you 10. I don't know if I could give you 20. So my cop-out answer is this. I'm going to put the national championship team up there. Okay?
Yep.
I'm going to put
a bundle.
My team, the 1971-72 team up there. And at the very top, I'm putting Tony Bennett.
All right.
That's it. I can't. I'm just.
Oh, it's your answer. That's,
way too close to so many players. I mean, Ralph.
I wasn't offended at all, Doug Smith, 1993. I'm fine with this.
I was going to ask, what has there been any talks of a statue, player or coach, at JPJ?
Not to my knowledge. Do you want me to answer your question that I think you're asking?
Yes.
Tony Bennett.
Yes. Have there been any discussions of anything like that? I can't imagine he would want that while he's here, obviously. But like, what about a Ralph Sampson or any, like, you know, an iconic player like that, or, you know, you, like, what?
We know better than that. I'm not high enough on the food chain to have those kinds of conversations. I do think you have to be very, very careful in doing something like that.
Because my question, you know, we talked about statues, and that we know that can cause a national uproar, but this one would be we'd like to think it's a positive one, right? And I'm just curious especially during that time when everyone was statue, had thought about, hey, let's put up a statue of an all-time great.
I don't have a vote there. The conversation's not really come up. I don't want to embarrass anybody here. I'd love to see Paul Jones' statue out in front of the John Paul Jones Arena. I mean, what that guy's done is more than extraordinary. Yeah. Way more than extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, and but Coach Bennett, you know, Terry Holland did a great job here. I mean, he did a phenomenal job. I think basketball's gone in cycles here to a certain extent. But what Tony's accomplished is, I mean, I consider myself the president of his fan club. But what he's done and the way he does it is truly amazing.
It's remarkable. Absolutely.
You're lucky. Thank goodness he's our coach.
Yep. Anything else, Mark?
No, Barry, you've been awesome. We really appreciate your time.
That was amazing.
No, you guys, I'm honored to be on it. I think what you're doing is way over my head, but I think part of what you're doing, you're going to bring guys in a Virginia basketball family back together.
The idea.
And I'm not saying this because Mark's here, but I got to say it. You know, your son is, we've gotten to know him fairly well, and what all those guys did is amazing. He's just a kid who, if everybody had his drive, there'd be a lot more great players in the world. But thank you for sending him here, and the guy had just an amazing career and loved watching him play. And he's also a guy that makes everybody else better. And he was surrounded by some pretty good players. But a shout out to you, Mark. And I'm always, obviously, keep my fingers crossed. He's going to have a great NBA career.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And it's great to have you on the show, because several former UVA, several grads of UVA in the past know who you are and remember you. And also, we hope that our younger audience will listen and understand what kind of influence and how important you are to the UVA basketball family. So we appreciate you.
Absolutely.
I appreciate being on. I've been lucky twice, going to school here and coming back to work, but I appreciate being on your show, guys.
Thank you so much.
That sounds great.
If you have any of your guys that would be interested or want the contact, or zero responsibility, but for them, but if they want to be involved in any way, whether it's a podcast, we just present what we're doing, maybe they'll be interested, you know.
I can't speak for them, but Wally Walker, Gus Gerard. I mean,
yeah, that'd be awesome.
You guys anybody. Tell me. I can make that happen.
Well, we appreciate the support. It's gonna just help us and hopefully help you guys as well. Hopefully we'll be helping each other.
I appreciate all you guys. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right, for T Dubs in Cali, for Doug Fresh Smith across the Hudson in Jersey City, I'm Mark Jerome, giving you Locker Room Access.
Tournament is about Diakite. Jerome off the hook.